Good afternoon, you are tuned to a Juno Afternoon for Wednesday, the 6th of January, the year 2016. Jeff Brown here with you today. We get an update on Eagle Crest activities with Jeffrey Clow. We get the details on this month's Wildlife Wednesday presentation on the Sitka Blacktail Deer. Sarah McNair Grove and Todd Hunt will offer a preview of this Saturday's Juno Community Band performance. And we'll highlight tonight's Alaska Design Forum offering by Mary Mattingly. That writer's almanac and more today on a Juno Afternoon. Weather forecast for tonight, partly cloudy skies, low temperature 16 to 27 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, mostly cloudy skies with high temperatures 29 to 34 degrees.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Families of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls are meeting with federal officials in Canada. Today's meeting in Thunder Bay, Ontario, is to get input for a national investigation. In December, the government announced plans. First Nations leaders have long called for an official investigation by the federal government. There have been about 1,200 documented cases since the early 1980s. Canada's Justice Minister, Jody Wilson-Raybould, a former First Nations chief, spoke at last month's announcement.
As a first step, we will meet with the families in the National Capital Region with the goal of hearing their views on the design of the inquiry and what it needs to achieve.
The government plans to hear from more families in coming months and others, including national Aboriginal organizations. On Tuesday, the government launched an online survey to gather input. Today's meeting is closed to the public and media due to the nature of the discussions. Summaries of the discussions will be posted to the Indigenous and Northern Affairs Canada's website as soon as they're made available, as well as information on upcoming meetings. State regulators have again approved the Keystone XL route to go through western South Dakota. On Tuesday, the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission validated TransCanada's certification that the pipeline could still be built following conditions laid out in a 2010 permit. The commission conducted a hearing last year, which included testimony from opponents. Tribes and native groups are among those fighting the pipeline. A presidential permit is still needed for the project. The Obama administration denied a permit in November. Proponents hope the next administration will overturn that decision. A pool of very cold air is set to descend from Canada into the Northern Plains this weekend. Forecasters say high temperatures may not reach zero and are urging people to find a way to stay warm before the cold conditions arrive. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
Areas of the plains are getting ready for two slow-moving storms over the next several days. The first could bring a mix of rain or wet snow before the weekend. National Weather Service meteorologist Carrie Hanko says not much accumulation is forecast, but she says incredibly cold air will follow the system.
Well, we're looking at temperatures to drop well below zero in the overnight hours. In fact, we're looking at probably in the teens below zero Saturday night into Sunday night. Sunday looks to be one of the coldest days we've seen so far this winter season. It's only looking at highs right around zero, within a few degrees above or below.
Hanko says all nine of South Dakota's reservations will feel the extreme cold, as will people on tribal lands across the plains. She says anyone worried about staying warm should start planning for the conditions as soon as they can.
If you're out and about, just make sure you dress for the temperatures. It's going to be bitterly cold out there. Be careful. If you are concerned about the heat in your household, seek out your friends, seek out the neighbors, look for help at a shelter near you.
Hanko says the cold weather could continue into the middle of next week. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
A Save the Mounds rally is planned to take place next week at the Wisconsin State Capitol. The Ho-Chunk Nation is among those concerned about protecting centuries-old burial mounds near McFarland, Wisconsin. The tribe says a bill by a state senator would force the Wisconsin Historical Society to allow property owners to excavate the mounds. Tribal historic preservation offices from around the state say the bill threatens not only Ho-Chunk burial sites, but burial sites of other tribes. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation is accepting artwork and reservations for the Alaska Native Art Auction, taking place February 18, 2016 in Anchorage, Alaska. Over 400 business leaders and executives attend this annual event. Proceeds benefit Kiwanis News Programming. Learn more at knba.org.
Support by the National Indian Health Board. Open enrollment for the health insurance marketplace ends January 31st. Many Indian health clinics are hosting enrollment events with help available. You may qualify for low-cost plans, zero copays, and deductibles. More info at healthcare.gov/tribal.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to Juno Afternoon. I'm Jeff Brown, I'm your host for today. In the studio with us now, first up, is Jeffrey Cloud from Eagle Crest. Jeffrey, thank you for coming down today.
Thanks for having me in the studio today, Jeff.
So what's the slopes like?
Oh, it's fabulous. We have great snow, and all the lifts are operating, and the runs are in great shape, and it's winter on the mountain, so we're really excited.
You got something special coming up this week?
Oh, yeah. So we have January's full of lots of events. This is January is Learn to Ski and Snowboard Month. And so we're encouraging everybody to get out, make the most of their winter, and learn how to ski or snowboard. And this is the season to do it. So coming up on Friday, we are participating in the world's largest lesson. It's a national attempt with over 150 ski areas across the country to participate, to get in the Guinness World Book of Records for the largest lesson. So the deadline to sign up for that is tomorrow at noon, and it's for first-time skiers and snowboarders.
And you've had some people sign up already.
Yeah, we do. We have about 40 people have signed up so far, so we saw some slots open, so you can find out more information and the registration form at skijuno.com. And again, those forms are due to us by noon tomorrow, and you can submit your registration form to eaglecrest@skijuno.com or by faxing it to 586-4583. So it's going to be a great day on the mountain, Jeff.
That's a pretty respectable number, given the fact that there's so many people already who have been taking advantage of the lessons.
Yeah, we've been busy. It's been great fun to share our passion for skiing and snowboarding with all the new people to the mountain. And we have so many great packages and so many great opportunities up there. One of the things I also wanted to mention is if Friday doesn't work out for you, next weekend, January 16th and 17th, is our annual Learn to Ski for Free weekend for 3rd, 4th, and 5th graders. So this is an amazing weekend sponsored by Mendenhall Auto Subaru. And those applications are online now. At skijuno.com, you can also find them in all the elementary schools. And that's for first-time skiers, kids who have never skied before, who want to learn how to ski as part of the Learn to Ski Free weekend in grades 3, 4, and 5.
Now, you've been doing this a number of years.
Yes, the Learn to Ski weekend, this is the 34th annual. And Mendenhall Auto Subaru have been our major sponsor for many years, and we certainly couldn't pull this weekend off without it. It includes free lessons, free lift tickets, free transportation, free equipment rentals. We just have a great time on the mountain with the kids. They learn how to ski. They meet some new buddies, and it's a whole weekend of fun. And the deadline for that application process is noon on Monday. So that's coming up, and we'll announce the winners for that. We pick 40 kids in grades 3, 4, and 5 who have never skied before, and we announce those winners on Wednesday, next Wednesday.
How many people are not using the lifts, but when the hill is closed, do backcountry?
Oh, there's a lot of people who get their exercise by skinning up, hiking up the mountain, and then skiing down. I can't even begin to guess on the number. It all depends upon the days. Some mornings I get up to the mountain at 7 o'clock and the parking lot's already got several cars in it, and I know they're out there hiking in the dark to get some turns in before they go to work.
And what else is coming up in the near future?
A couple other things on the books in January. We have our annual Learn to Adapt Day, which is January 17th. That's our Adaptive Ski and Snowboarding Awareness Day. So it's a great opportunity to come out and take a lesson in a monoski, on a bi-ski, try a three-track, the outriggers, or four-track, or just get a little bit of more information on adaptive skiing and snowboarding. And then if there's any Haynes listeners in the area, We are doing a Learn to Adapt Day in Haines on January 23rd. So we partner with our friends at Sail and Orca, and we're just trying to increase the awareness and get more adaptive skiers and snowboarders on the mountain.
Jeffrey, is there anything you'd like to add?
Just that it's great skiing and snowboarding on the mountain. Visit SkiJuno.com and make the most out of your winter and get on up to Eagle Crest. It's way better than staying in town.
Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 6th of January, 2016. It's the birthday of the man who said writing is like driving a car at night. You can only see as far as your headlights illuminate, but you can make the whole trip that way. That was E.L. Doctorow, Edgar Lawrence Doctorow, born in the Bronx, 1931, best known for his novel Ragtime. It takes place in and around New York as World War I is looming. Fictional characters interacting with historical figures, Evelyn Nesbit and Henry Ford, Teddy Roosevelt, Harry Houdini, and so forth. Doctorow went to college, got out of the Army, worked as a reservations clerk at LaGuardia, script reader at CBS Television. He was an editor at Dial Press, and then quit and started working on his novel, The Book of Daniel. It came out in 1971. 3 years later came Ragtime, made into a movie by Milos Forman and adapted for Broadway, became a long-running musical. E.L. Doctorow, who said, when you're writing a book, you don't really think about it critically. You don't want to know too well what you're doing. First you write the book, then you find the justification for it. The book is constructed as a conversation with someone doing most of the talking and someone doing most of the listening. It's the birthday of Barry Lopez, born in Port Chester, New York, 1945, author of Arctic Dreams and of Wolves and Men. Barry Lopez, who said, everything is held together with stories. That is all that is holding us together, stories and compassion. It's the birthday of the novelist Elizabeth Strout, born Portland, Maine, 1956. Her family lived in Maine for 8 generations, grew up in a series of small towns. Her first novel was Amy and Isabel, 1998, followed by a book of linked short stories, Olive Kittredge, and in between, a bestseller, Abide With Me. And it's the birthday of the poet Khalil Gibran, born in a mountain village in Lebanon in 1883. His mother brought her 4 children to America. They settled in Boston. Members of the Boston aristocracy found Gibran charming. They invited him to social gatherings where he recited his poems. And he was heard by Alfred A. Knopf, who published his book, The Prophet, in 1923, which became very popular in the 1960s. And Khalil Gibran, now the 3rd best-selling poet in history, after William Shakespeare and Lao Tzu. Here's a poem for today by Joy Sutphen entitled Our Fathers. Our fathers, who lived all their lives on earth, are going now. They have given us all we need, and when we asked, they gave us more. Their names are beautiful to us, holy as the names of stars, as familiar as the roads we traveled, falling asleep on the way from one farm to another. Their kingdoms were small. They were never interested in more than one homestead. And as for evil, although they could not keep it from us, they tried to keep us from temptation, though we were like all children and wanted our own power and glory, world without end, forever and amen. Our Fathers, by Joy Sutphen, from her collection After Words, published by Red Dragonfly Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can subscribe to the Poetry Magazine podcast and the Poetry Off the Shelf podcast in the iTunes store or listen at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about 15 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to a Juno afternoon. Here we have next, we'll be talking to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, Wildlife Biologist Karen McCoy and Patricia Weary from the Alaska Wildlife Alliance Southeast about tonight's Wildlife Wednesday presentation. Thank you so much for coming down to the station
today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, other than the obvious, what's unique about the Sitka black-tailed deer?
Well, the Sitka black-tailed deer are pretty amazing. They're one of the most hunted species in southeast Alaska, and they're actually extremely important for subsistence purposes. They fill a lot of freezers in the winter.
What's their preferred habitat?
Well, deer actually use a lot of different habitat. It really depends on the season. The most critical habitat for them is old growth, especially during severe winters.
Tell me something about deer that most people don't know.
Something about deer that most people don't know. That's a good question. I would say that deer will eat a number of different variety of foods, and that sometimes during the winter times, people will see them eating things on the beaches like seaweed or different items just to fill up their bellies during severe winters, but those items are actually not nutritious and they can't digest those foods. And so just because a deer eats something doesn't mean that it's necessarily getting the nutrition it needs. So that's just something to keep in mind if you happen to see them concentrated out there doing that during a severe winter.
What do they eat normally and what eats them?
What they eat normally is a variety of different plants, and it depends on if it's summer or winter. During the summers, they focus on herbaceous vegetation, green vegetation, and the green plants of leaves. And during winter, they like evergreen forbs as well as woody vegetation, such as blueberry or lichens or bed cedar.
And what eats them?
What eats them? There are a couple of main predators, which are bears and wolves, and then, of course, humans. We have quite a bit of hunting of deer in southeast Alaska.
What's a day in the life of a Sitka black-tailed deer?
A day in the life of a Sitka black-tailed deer probably consists of a lot of eating and then resting and ruminating and then eating a little bit more, maybe doing a little walkabout, resting a little bit more, eating a little bit more. They're pretty mellow. They've actually got it pretty good. Oh, and keeping their eyes up for predators, of course.
What interests you personally in deer?
I think that deer are just amazing creatures. They're really resilient. They have a lot to contend with here in southeast Alaska. They've got hunters, they've got predators, and they occasionally have to deal with some pretty severe winters. They have systems that are uniquely built up for that, where they put on reserves throughout the year to get them through the winter for when those hard times occur. So I really admire their resiliency, and when they do get knocked down, their ability to bounce back. They can be very productive. Most deer of mature age are reproducing every year and often having twins. And so even when their populations get knocked down, they can really bounce back pretty quickly if given the chance.
Where do you find most deer in southeast Alaska?
Doesn't everyone want to know that question? People always ask me where to find the deer. There's deer pretty much everywhere in southeast Alaska. They're actually on all of the islands as well as the mainland except Forester Island because it's pretty remote. And they're there because they're good swimmers. They migrated up from British Columbia after the Ice Age. And so you can pretty much find them everywhere, but there's higher concentrations on the islands and higher concentrations or densities of deer in Unit 2 and Unit 4.
I'm having an interesting time visualizing a deer swimming.
Oh, you'll see them. And if you ask fishermen, they see them out there swimming between the islands here and there. Why they look out across a vast expanse of water and decide to swim from one side to the other, that I can't tell you. Only the deer knows.
Patricia Weary, can you tell me a little bit about the Alaska Wildlife Alliance Southeast?
Well, this is the one and only chapter of Alaska Wildlife Alliance, Southeast Chapter. and it is a nonprofit organization that looks to the creatures, the wild creatures in Alaska, a lobbying type of outfit, wanting to make sure that there are habitats and animals here in the future. And a lot of people make use of them. They in themselves are important, just their being. And then there are the hunters after them for different kind of hunting reasons, and the whole web of life that that any little one animal interacts in. So it's a good organization to belong to.
And tonight's presentation is at 7 o'clock in a new location.
Ah, new location, yes. We're going to be in that brand new library out in the valley, not right next to the swimming pool. There's a lot of parking there. You might have to walk a little bit to get over to the library, but there's a lot of parking. Come right in the front door, and the big room on the left-hand side is where we'll be. And we still have lots of cookies. I've got brownies all made up and ready to go.
Did you bring some to the studio with you?
Oh, I should have thought of that. How cruel of me just to tell you.
I guess he's going to have to come to the presentation.
I think he might be working.
That starts at 7 o'clock. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you'd like to end? I might have forgotten to ask.
I just hope that everyone braves the weather and comes on out to see the presentation tonight to learn a little bit more about our Alaskan Sitka black-tailed deer.
Karen McCoy and Patricia Ware, thank you for coming by the station today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's 24 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to a Juno afternoon. My next guests in the studio are Sarah McNair Grove and Todd Hunt, here to talk about Saturday's Juno Community Band Performance. Thanks for coming down to the station.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. Good to be here.
So, for people who don't know, what is the community band?
Okay. Juno Community Bands is an organization that helps adult wind, percussion, brass players play music, and most people probably know us as the Juno Volunteer Marching Band in the 4th of July parades. But we also have a concert band, which we call Taku Winds, as a wind ensemble, which plays, what shall I say, other things than march and band and light music. And our concert on Saturday is sort of a growth and expansion of that that allows small chamber music groups to play. And my definition of chamber music is a small ensemble in an intimate setting. Todd may have a more official definition than that. But
that sounds pretty good.
Yeah,
and without a conductor.
Right.
So it's the all of the players sort of playing with each other without external stimuli to keep them together, or and the players have all of the artistic decisions and that kind of thing.
I've never heard that before. That's been interesting.
Yeah.
What are you be playing on Saturday night?
Well, I personally will be playing in a saxophone trio. Since I'm, you know, they don't want me as a conductor.
We want him as a player this time.
No, it's fun to play every once in a while too. Get you know my chops back in shape. Anyway, so I'm playing in a saxophone trio, and we're doing like five small short pieces of rather distinctly different character. Everything from a you know a late romantic arrangement to sort of new jazzy kind of stuff. Too. So, yeah.
How many musicians are in the band?
We have five different small groups that are playing, and I think that encompasses 11 or 12 different individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So we have quite a variety. We have the saxophone trio that Todd talked about. We have a flute duet. We have a clarinet trio. And we have one brass instrument, and that will be a trumpet solo.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a nice variety of groups playing.
What time does it start and where?
It starts at 8 o'clock on Saturday night, and it is here in the KTOO 360 studio. We thought that would be sort of a nice, intimate place to have chamber music, so we're looking mm-hmm. forward to that.
How do you determine what pieces you're going to be playing?
Well, each group, when they get together, they would, well, at least the way the saxophone group worked is one person might say, hey, I think we should do this. And from there, the group talks and comes up with a lineup of things that they're going to play. And I'm sure each group operates in sort of the same way to some degree anyway, or they sometimes it could be there's a piece and somebody says, I want to play this piece, and it happens to be for, you know, this group of instruments. And so then you go out and find those people. Or you might have two or three people who want to play something together, and then they look for pieces for that combination. So that's one of the neat things about wind chamber music, you know, as opposed to string chamber music that has pretty standard groupings. Like you have the string quartet, and you have like piano trios. It's a piano, a cello, and a violin, for instance. There's not as standard a group for the winds. We've got the woodwind quintet, of which we don't actually have any woodwind quintet.
We
so
don't.
This is a very non-standard kind of concert.
Yeah.
So that's one of the interesting things, is you get a lot of different combinations of sounds than you normally might.
What composers are well known for composing chamber music?
Oh, gosh. Well, I would like to say that any composer worth their salt is a good chamber music composer, because it's one of the most intimate forms of instrumental writing. So when you have one to five voices that you can work with, there's a lot more, I think in a lot of ways, a lot more personality that can go into each one of those parts. We've had great chamber music composers for hundreds of years now, and I could begin, but then I'd, you know, feel bad about leaving somebody off.
Yeah.
So just about anybody you can think of.
Yeah. Yeah. On this particular concert, we have two very well-known composers, Mozart and Haydn.
Mm-hmm.
Pieces by them will be represented. And then we have some totally unknown. The clarinet trio is playing a modern piece by a guy called Massimiliano Pido. I bet nobody's ever heard of him. And I think the saxophone trio is playing a piece by David Berndt, which, mm-hmm. again, is probably an unknown composer. So we have a
right.
real wide variety of music.
Yeah.
How long do you practice?
Well, I'm playing in the clarinet trio, and we've talked about doing this concert for maybe 4 months and probably 2.5 months ago, we started getting together knowing that Christmas vacations were going to come up and people were dispersing. So we practice about once a week for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, we've been cramming. The saxophone trio has been cramming them in when we can. So we do like 3 days in a row of intense rehearsal, and then we take like a week off for Christmas or whatever, and then we're going to do 3 days in a row. And then now, yeah, we're doing another 3 days in a row.
You mentioned the communication that goes on between the instrumentalists in chamber music. What kind of improvisation happens?
Well, improvisation wouldn't happen so much in the notes, at least, you know, on purpose. but totally improvisation in the in styles. And that's another neat thing with chamber music is somebody could, like one of the saxophone trio pieces we're doing is a tango. And sometimes when two of us have the accompaniment figure, we might change slightly how we accentuate the background kind of feel while the person doing the melody does their own thing. And that can change from rehearsal to rehearsal to performance, and one might not be any better than the other. But that's the sort of thing that happens on the fly. And when you have a small number of people, it's very fluid in that way. So it's very, very interesting, and it's kind of too bad there's only one performance, because it'd be nice to hear how things change in a second.
You mentioned the tango. Is the audience going to be invited to dance along?
I think they should. I don't know. We're going to have room. maybe we should open
have
up a dance floor.
Aisle, huh?
Yeah, we'll give them an aisle. Yeah, bring your dancing shoes.
And Sam, can you tell me again the time and date of the concert?
It is at 8:00 on Saturday, January 9th, at 360 Studio down here in the KTO building.
And how can people get tickets?
It is free.
Yay.
We are going to have donations at the door, but don't let that stop you. We just love to have that room filled with people.
Mm-hmm. It's that the concerts I've been to, everybody seems to have a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We do. We have a lot of fun. I think the players have really enjoyed putting these kinds of pieces together. It's very different when you play in a group of two or three than when you play in a group of 20 or 30. You have to listen to each other differently.
Yeah, and you have all of the everything is on you, or at least like a third of
it,
rather than
really
a 30th.
It's really noticeable when you're good and really noticeable when you're slub.
Things don't work, right. Or you might be able to hide in a large group.
Right.
Sarah McNew-Grove and Tom Hunt, thanks for coming by. Is there anything you'd like to add? I'm unforgotten to ask.
No, I don't think so.
Just come and see us January 9th, 8:00.
Yeah.
This is Bird Note. Looking for a project for a winter's day? Consider giving screech owls a helping hand. Eastern and western screech owls span the wooded areas of the continent, nesting in naturally occurring tree cavities left vacant by large woodpeckers. Such natural housing opportunities are often in short supply, though. And that's where you come in, because screech owls will happily take to nest boxes. In fact, they'll nest in wood duck boxes, flicker boxes, and even the occasional mailbox. But you can build an ideal home for them with a few pieces of wood, a saw, and an hour or two of your spare time. The owls like an area with ample trees, but they'll also nest right next to your house. You'll need to attach the box to a tree or post at least 10 feet above ground, which helps the owls sneak in and out. When leaving the box, an owl drops low to the ground and stays low in flight for some distance to elude potential predators, like larger owls or raccoons. Screech owls start courting as early as February, so now is the ideal time to get started. For tips on building and installing your screech owl box, come to birdnote.org.
It's 35 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to June Afternoon. I'm Jeff, and I'm your host for today. In the studio with me next is Aaron Suring from the Alaska Robotics folks, and they're here to talk about
the Jump Society. Yeah. And we've got a new film festival coming up next week, and I would love to get some more submissions. We actually I come on here, and it's last minute, and we're just talking about screening the films, but we still have a whole week left, and we're accepting submissions. So If you got a film, bring it by. We'd love to have it in our show.
This is the what annual?
Oh, well, so we do it twice a year, and we've been doing it since 2002. This is going to be our 26th festival. So, yeah, that's pretty exciting.
What films have you seen so far come in?
I haven't seen a lot of them yet. We do have some stuff from up in the Arctic. There's a couple of things being done up there, some ethnographic stuff and some stuff about power and generation and how they're dealing with stuff up there. So that's kind of interesting documentary stuff. We got some things from some high schoolers that looks pretty fun. That's going to be more storyline driven. I know there's at least one really pretty interesting fight scene out there that I've seen. They were working on the choreographing for it, and it looks really good. So that should be pretty fun too.
That's a special art choreographing a fight scene.
Yeah, and then we actually have a really good one here in town. He actually went down to Hollywood and was working down there for a little while. So was helping out with some stuff down there, and he's back in town, and this is some evidence of that. So it should be pretty fun.
How many films do you have in so far?
I'm not even quite sure. I know it's somewhere in the 10 to so range, but the deadline isn't for a couple of days, so that's normally when they all come pouring in for the last little bit.
So the show is at the Goldtown and also at UAS?
Yes, yeah, we're doing Goldtown next week, and then UAS is at the end of the month.
What time and how can people get tickets?
Tickets are available down at the Alaska Robotics Gallery on Front Street, 220 Front Street, next to the Gross Alaska Theater down there. The shows start next Thursday at 7, and Friday and Saturday at 7 and 9. And we finally completed our 501c3 paperwork, so we're an actual federal nonprofit, not just a state nonprofit. So I know Lou's working to get some beer donated from the brewery, so we're going to maybe have some beer at the late shows. So hopefully that'll happen. Don't know that for sure yet, but that's maybe in the works.
And you're also working with the young people doing some zines.
That's a different project, but this first Friday, this weekend is our comic arts, student show. So down at the gallery, from 4 to 7, for first Friday, we'll have, a selection of art from what students are working on these days. And that's always really fun to see.
Cool. Aaron Sterling, thanks for coming by. Is there anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
I don't think so. Yeah, just come out and come watch some films next week. And if you've got something to submit, we're accepting them until this weekend. So, yeah, bring it by. We'd love to have it. Thanks so much.
support comes from North End Audiology and Hearing Services, working with medical professionals to diagnose hearing disorders and prescribe solutions. North End Audiology and Hearing Services. Information at 789-6780.
for this station comes from the Augustus Brown Swimming Pool, located at 1619 Glacier Avenue in downtown Juneau, offering aqua aerobics on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. until 12 p.m., and stretch aquatics on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 11 a.m. until 11:45 a.m. Schedules are available online at juneau.org/parkrec/pool. More information at 586-5325.
It's about 13 minutes before the hour, and you are tuned to Juneau Afternoon. In the studio with me now is Mary Mattingly. She's the Alaska Design Forum speaker tonight at the Gold Town that starts at 6 o'clock. She's a New York-based artist creating sculptural expressions, sculptural ecosystems in urban spaces. She's also working on a floating food forest. Mary, thank you for coming down to the station today.
Thanks for having me.
What defines your work?
Oh, a lot of things. You know, I think about ecosystems, food, water, and energy, and what goes into making things that we need for our lives and how necessary art is as well. And I sort of try to combine all those things and make something that works.
Tell me about the floating food forest.
So it's built with shipping containers made to float. So they're welded shut. And the food forest concept is based in permaculture. So the idea and the hope is that over time, over a couple of years, it takes a lot less work to upkeep the food forest, and you can pretty much let it go. It's one of the, what's really important about it to me is that in New York right now, it's illegal to grow public food in public spaces, and the floating food forest gets away with it because it's on the water, and it's still a public space. And hopefully if it goes well, that could have some influence in policy in the city.
What got you started in the direction you're heading?
I guess I grew up in a town that had a lot of water problems, and I've always thought about water, clean water for drinking especially, but then as there have been more and more really devastating floods in the United States, I've thought about it from that aspect as well. That's the short answer. So I started as a photographer and started photographing water, and then started to, you know, photograph landscapes and water, and then started to make these water purification devices that became really sculptural. They made their way into these portable units that were wearable sculptures. So they really took on a life of their own that became bigger than these little water sculptures. They became wearable, and then they became community-sized. So they became large enough to house several people, and then, 20s and 30s and hundreds of people. So I think about water a lot in the work and how we can kind of make what we need in a very interdependent way. So then, yeah, from there, I think I really started to focus on interdependency of cities and resources, including water, but also food and, like I said, energy and shelter.
Do you remember your first piece of art and well, when you thought, I'm an artist now?
I think it was making a wearable home. I was, you know, taking lots of photographs before that and thought of myself as a photographer. And I think the difference was that making the wearable home was using another skill set that I hadn't really been able to use. My mother would sew all of our clothes when my brother, sister, and I were growing up. And so that's something that I always knew how to do and loved doing. And it was a way to work with my hands in a different way. So I think combining those two things really felt like something different and unique.
What do you think is the job of public art, and maybe as others do it or as you do it?
Well, I think it's to inspire. I think that, you know, depending on the piece, it can be a way to share stories. I think it's a lot more in a way, it's more relevant because it reaches more people, but it really depends also on how it's disseminated. So I think that the space between public art and art in, say, a gallery or a museum is massive. It's huge. And I think that those spaces can be combined in different ways, and I think that's important to do, too.
How does your public art work differ from your solo show work?
Sometimes the solo show work is really directly related to the public work, but it's really more of a representation of it. And the public work is more active. So the way that I usually do work in public space involves collaborators, and it involves lots of moving parts. And things don't really stay still in the same way. And when they're in the gallery, when something is in the gallery later, it's usually a representation of that.
Can you tell me more about the process of collaboration that you work with?
Depending on the sculpture, the project, sometimes I'll end up collaborating with students, other times engineers, usually always lawyers.
Well, why lawyers?
I think there's always a heavy insurance aspect to the work. So unfortunately, maybe, or you know, fortunately for people who might come across it and use it in the wrong way, there's a level of risk involved in setting something up in public space always. So the riskier it is, and the riskier it is, I think the more interesting it is to me, and the more I depend on need those other infrastructures that exist in cities in order to allow it to happen in public space, depending on the place.
We're talking to Mary Mattingly. She's talking tonight at 6 o'clock at the Goaltown. It's part of the Alaskan Design Forum's presentation series. When you came to Juneau, what did you have to drop? You're probably working on something right now in New York.
Well, I'm working on the floating food forest and something else that I think is... Well, so let me tell you about something I just finished maybe, because the thing I'm working on right now is a little, it's too undefined really for me to give a good explanation of it, but I just finished something that I thought was pretty wild. It was an underwater bridge in Des Moines through a river called the Raccoon River, and it was apparently the first time that something like that had to be insured, which was pretty great. But the bridge was, you know, a few inches underwater, so people actually walked through the water instead of above the water. And in that river in particular, it's where all of the runoff from the agriculture industry sort of gathers, and the floods in that river are really severe, and also the water's pretty polluted, so people took a risk walking through it, and it was the first time a lot of people did. That I think was a very experiential thing, so I was glad that it could happen.
As an artist, what went through your head when you found out that you had to deal with insurance?
What went through my head? I thought there has to be a way that somebody besides Lloyd's of London will underwrite this, or it'll just be too expensive and it would never happen.
What are you going to be talking about tonight?
I want to talk about the project that I'm approaching the Anchorage Museum with. It's called Trepidation of the Spheres, and I wanted to talk about Waterpod, which is a floating ecosystem, and some other projects that I'll save.
Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask. What would you tell people who are on the fence about public art, and how does one enjoy public art?
Well, I think that I don't really think there's a reason to be on the fence about public art. I think that it's so many great things can happen through it, and some things can happen through public art that can't really happen in any other way. There's a safety to doing something as an artwork that sometimes can be temporary and doesn't have to involve the same level of fear as a building, maybe, or something like that, something that's grander in scale, usually. So I think that there's a way to push boundaries that should be exciting, not frightening.
Mary Mattingly, thank you for coming down to the station today.
Thanks for having me.
It'll be 6 o'clock at the Goaltown Theater. There's a mission charge to get in, but it goes towards the good people at the Alaska Design Forum for putting this on. Thanks for coming by again.
Thanks.
tomorrow on a junior afternoon. Joan Pardis will be your host. UAS Humanities faculty members Rosemary Alexander and Kevin Meyer will be there to talk about spring course offerings. Chef Steph will be here to highlight this month's show at the Juno Artists Gallery. We'll also talk with artist Jacob Hibb against about his first radio show at the Jack. And Nancy Cherney will be here with Arts Out. Well, the forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies, partly cloudy skies, low temperatures 16 to 25. Forecast for Thursday, mostly cloudy skies with high temperatures 25 to 34 degrees. Thursday night, mostly cloudy skies, low temperatures 21 to 29 degrees. Doesn't say rain in the forecast except for Saturday night. Coming up next, All Things Considered.